Well, we've talked about three agencies by which heaven works to cooperate and help to ensure our salvation. And now we move to another topic, and that will be how we handle things when things don't go so good. That can happen too in an imperfect world. Things aren't going so good this afternoon, are they? In a very troubled world. We are concerned about the future and how things will turn out in the case of world events. And I might say right now that we have a full program that we've planned especially for American Cassette Ministries, and I deeply appreciate what Al Newhart and his daughter and all the other fine crew, Kathy and everyone do at American Cassette. It's filling a real need in this church. And I want to do this series as we've planned it so that they can have a complete series of tapes that flows logically from one topic to another. Perhaps when we're done today, we can, if you want to, talk just a little bit about the Middle East. Off the record, off the tape, just talk about it. Think things through ourselves and see where we think the world is going. But whatever happens in the world, you see, in the short term, in the Middle East, Iraq, the Persian Gulf, or whatever, those are like waves on the ocean. And you come into high places in life, into low places, as Isis so beautifully described for us in the experience of her life. And we all face these things. But over the long haul, there has to be still a direction we travel, even though life buffets us. We hit turbulence sometimes. And that is why I think perhaps this weekend of all weekends, as war comes to the world, it's appropriate to talk about the basics of how we relate to the Lord and how we live the Christian life. And so we talk about how you handle things when things go wrong. Basically, the power of forgiveness. See, there's great energy in evil. Evil sets up a force of energy that begs to be responded to in kind. And evil thus becomes kind of self-perpetuating. As evil impacts another human life, that human life is capable of re-energizing the blow and actually adding fuel to the energy so that it tends to spiral and compound and become an ever greater problem, much as when a pitcher throws that ball at a batter at somewhat over 100 miles an hour and the batter swings, the resulting impact greatly multiplies the force of the initial pitch, and the thing may go clear out of the park and all the way downtown, or, as we discovered in our boyish baseball game, sometimes through the neighbor's window. See? And so the problem with evil is that when it is responded to with another force of evil, the force tends to grow. And Jesus gave us an example of how you deal with that problem, because evil likes to live on. And if it gets re-energized every time it touches a life, pretty soon we have a big problem where a small one might have been contained. And Jesus suggests the way you handle evil is to take the energy out of the system, and it dies on its own. And let's this afternoon see how Jesus did that in perhaps the most spectacular exercise of forgiveness that history could ever imagine. And we go to John 18. And the chapter opens with Jesus and 11 disciples in an upper room, which has to have been fairly large, because the early Christian church, after Jesus was resurrected, after his ascension, was formed of a nucleus of probably somewhat in excess of 100 people. And they all met in this upper room, the men and women with whom Jesus had had actual contact back during his lifetime on earth. So the room was large enough to accommodate a pretty good crowd. It may very easily have been nearly the size of this room, perhaps not so large, but large enough that a good-sized crowd would be accommodated there. Very possibly the upstairs room in the home of John Mark. We don't know for sure, but that's one theory. And they're having the Passover supper together, and then it's time to go. And out on the eastern rim of the valley there, just over the low rise of the Mount of Olives, this full Passover moon rises, washes the valley with light, and all of Jerusalem turns silver from the moonlight of a full Passover moon. And these men go out from that upper room down a stairway and out into the very crooked and very narrow streets of Old Jerusalem, and probably out through one of two or three gates in the eastern wall of the city. They cross down a little narrow ravine where the Kidron creek will flow, at least seasonally, and then they go up the other side and find themselves within just a few hundred yards of the temple itself in a place called Gethsemane, place of the olive press. Now, in Gethsemane, then as now, there were olive trees. The ones that are there now could not possibly have been there at the time of Jesus, because when the Romans finally destroyed Jerusalem, they cut all of the trees down for several hundred yards around the city so there would be no place to hide. They would have an open field of fire. So what has come up has to have come up since that time, although they're very old and very big. But in those days, as now, there were olive trees there, and in the garden there was this round olive press into which they would put the fruit and then put a sort of a pressure plate on it. And over that would be a lever that hung out several feet, and on that lever they would hang very heavy stones, so that by the action of leverage, great force would be applied to the olives in this olive press, and little by little, as they were crushed, the oil came out of them. And the oil represents what? Holy Spirit. And in Gethsemane, Jesus would have to face a similar experience, you see. And he's on his knees. He leaves the disciples a few paces away, but close enough they can hear. And he's on his knees, and which direction do you suppose he kneels as he prays? Toward the temple. Exactly right. Remember the time way back in 1 Kings 8 when Solomon dedicated the temple. He says, if ever there is a crisis in Israel, if our people are dispersed, they will pray toward this place. Well, was there a crisis in Israel this night? Yes, there was. El Maximo. You know, there's nothing greater. The Son of God is about to be crucified in this place, and I'm sure he prays toward the temple. And he's praying toward a place which for 1,000 years, divine guidance with his personal participation, has set up a system of justice that says there under no circumstances will this nation, will this council called the Sanhedrin ever convict an innocent person. And from this, the Sanhedrists for centuries had absorbed this concept that this was a house of mercy and there was absolutely never to be the wrongful conviction of someone who is innocent of a crime. And they had a saying in the Sanhedrin, we would rather let 12 guilty people go free than to convict one person who is not guilty. And the whole system of justice that the Lord himself had helped to set up in the Old Testament Levitical laws was designed to make it impossible to do what is going to be done this night. So Jesus is on his knees facing the temple and he's in prayer. And he begins to learn how unreliable human friends can be. And some of you may have discovered that for yourselves. And the Bible says, cursed be he that maketh flesh his arm. And I myself have learned that you cannot rely on people. And so, having already lost Judas in the opening drama of this night, he now senses his return. In John 18, verse 1 says, when Jesus had spoken these words, he went forth with his disciples over the brook Kidron, where there was a garden, into the which he entered and his disciples. And Judas also, which betrayed him, knew the place. The irony, of course, is that this is just a very short distance from the temple platform itself, but it is, after 3.5 years, still so unknown to the Pharisees that they need a guide to get there to find where Jesus sleeps at night, where he prays and so forth. Well, Judas knew the place well. And the gate swings open, I would guess probably between midnight and 1 o'clock in the morning, right along in there, in the very dark portions of midnight. Out through the gate comes this crowd of temple police, of Pharisees, of Judas himself, and whoever else happens to kind of gather in with this group and get swept along with it. There's this sparkle of torchlight, babble of voices, and do you suppose the east wall of Jerusalem makes an excellent sounding board so that whatever is said projects out and sweeps across the little valley there and sweeps into the Garden of Gethsemane? So Jesus hears them coming, and he hears their words. And verse 4 describes it well. It says, Jesus, therefore, knowing all things that should come upon him, went forth and said, whom seek ye? He didn't turn his back on evil. He went forth to meet it. Now he's going forth to meet not only the betrayal of one of the inner circle, but the betrayal of a system that he himself had set up, designed, to protect the innocent and to act like the plan of salvation itself. And it is not hard to imagine, after the fast and furious little fight between Peter and one of the official servants there, that when the disciples finally break and flee, when they realize Jesus is going to allow himself to be taken, they flee into the dark. The second blow falls. Jesus has already lost one. Now all of them go, 11 go, probably also a young man. And I think we're still talking about John Mark. Remember how one of the Gospels says one of them stripped out of his clothes and fled. He was so anxious to get away that modesty no longer mattered. And he fled into the dark with his clothes still in the hands of whoever was trying to hold him. Very possibly that was Mark. They all scatter to the winds. And then angry hands take the hands of Jesus and wrench his wrists behind him and tie his hands off. And I'm sure they're not terribly concerned about circulation. They give him a shove, probably with a boot in the backside, and send him down the path, back across the very path he's just come over, probably an hour or two before, and head him toward the temple, either the palace of Caiaphas or a place in the temple called Lishkath HaGazeth, the Hall of Hewn Stones, where traditionally all capital trials are supposed to be held. And he goes into the arms of the Jewish legal system, and there's no parallel for this system anywhere in comparative law. There was supposed to be no prosecutor. The office didn't even exist. There was no official prosecuting attorney. The witnesses themselves were supposed to prosecute the accused. And there was no defense counsel, because there didn't need to be any. The Sanhedrin itself, all 71 of them, all of them the top Jewish lawyers in the nation and hence in the whole world, were charged not only with hearing the case and judging the accused, but as acting as defense counsel for the accused. So you understand that when Jesus goes into the Sanhedrin, it is the job of this group, nearly 70 men, the brightest lawyers in the world, not only to act as his judge, but to cross-examine the witnesses brutally and tear their stories apart if they possibly can, the whole object being to let the accused go free. Now, have you ever heard of a court where you are to be judged, which also acts as your attorney? It doesn't exist. It would be unethical here for the judge to be on your side of the case. You see, he's supposed to be impartial. In the Jewish system, the judge was your defense attorney. Now, what does that make you think of? The plan of salvation. The reason it works this way is God designed it. Well, Jesus goes into this courtroom, wherever it was held. It's not possible, really, to tell. Probably in the palace of the high priest, although there is a possibility they held it in the Hall of Hewn Stones in the temple. But wherever it happened, as he walks in, the court is assembling. And the judges, 71, are supposed to be there. I suspect tonight there are probably only 69, because I don't think that Nicodemus or Joseph were invited to this particular party. But there are a semicircular row of pillows, kind of sitting in an arc there in the floor. And these are the thrones. These are the pillows upon which the judges will sit. Remember when Daniel looked into the future and he says, "I beheld and thrones were cast down"? And they did sit. Remember Daniel 7? He saw thrones cast down. Hebrew word for that are these big pillows that the judges sat on. They took their sandals off because they're on holy ground. They sit cross-legged on these pillows in a big circle. The high priest is right in the center, and he walks in solemn procession. On his head is this turban of blue inwrought with gold upon which is written, "Holiness to the Lord." On his bosom is the breastplate of judgment. His robe is blue and is gathered about the waist with a girdle of purple, scarlet, and gold embroidery. There's fine white linen, which is his main gown, and around the bottom are the bells and pomegranates that represent the sanctuary service of the Lord. And he takes his seat, and in front of the high priest sit three scribes. The one on the left will record the votes for conviction. The one in the middle will record both the votes for conviction and the votes for acquittal. And the scribe on the right-hand side will record the votes to convict the prisoner. And the court opens, and Jesus stands right before the high priest, and he's standing before the best people in the world, humanly speaking. The Sanhedrin is the cream of the cream, the brightest and best lawyers in Israel. They must be of Hebrew parentage. They must be learned in the law, both current law and obsolete law. They have to know all the laws that ever applied in Israel. Many of them have much of the Torah committed to memory. They have to have the experience as sitting judges in lower courts, because now they're on the Supreme Court. They must be accomplished scientists. They have to understand how things work. Rabbi Ismael is renowned, as I said earlier, for his dissections of the human body and his knowledge. They must be accomplished linguists. There are no translators for the court. The court itself must understand whatever language is spoken to it. Most important of all, they must be friendly toward the accused, and there cannot, under Hebrew law, be any enemy of the accused on the court. If anyone on the court feels a negative bias toward the prisoner, it is his duty to get up off that pillow, put on his shoes, and leave the hall of judgment. Now, against that, is it interesting to note that Annas and Caiaphas are said to have owned the cattle stalls that Jesus had twice emptied in his ministry. Today, I think the term we might apply to that is conflict of interest. And now we pick up the story of how Jesus' trial went. We'll look at verse 13 of John 18. They led him away to Annas first, for he was father-in-law to Caiaphas, which was high priest that same year. Now Caiaphas was he which gave counsel to the Jews that it was expedient that one man should die for the people. In other words, the court has already made up its mind. Well, one by one, the witnesses came in. And let's turn over, if we can, to Mark. I think about Mark 14. We pick up the story of what happened in the trial of Jesus. And Mark 14:53 kind of picks it up where we just left it off in John. And it says, they led Jesus away to the high priest, and with him were assembled all the chief priests and the elders of the scribes. And as we read that now, we can get a kind of a mental picture of these priests coming in their official robes, solemnly walking in slow procession, taking their shoes off, sitting in that semicircle of pillows, the high priest in the very center, the scribe sitting down. And then somewhere in the corner out there, at a far distance off, is Peter. Peter followed him afar off, even into the palace of the high priest, and sat with the servants and warmed himself at the fire. And now Jesus learns another lesson as to how frail human friendship can be, because during the course of the morning, as Jesus is undergoing a trial that systematically begins to butcher the best legal system that has ever existed in the world, he hears a shrill voice of Peter out there in the distance. Peter, you see, has had a great deal of confidence in his ability to serve the Lord. And he promised him that night, don't worry about it, Jesus. Now the rest of these fellows, they may not be reliable, but I'm with you to the end. I'll die with you. He reaches down and he feels the hilt of that sword. Fisherman's sword, no doubt. They probably use it to cut weeds and kelp off the anchor line, to dress fish, to whatever they do. He knows how to use it. And he tries that morning, and he realizes, suddenly, that Jesus is not going to resort to physical force. And Peter now is blindsided by a threat that he never imagined would happen. See, he expected to go down fighting. He never expected his final catastrophic failure to come at the hands of a little lady that may be 5'2". And suddenly Jesus hears in the distance that voice, harsh and shrill with adrenaline, saying, blankety blanket, I don't know the blankety blank. And then the cock crows, and the morning wears on. And against that background, Jesus now has to endure trial. And we pick the story up in verse 55. And the chief priests and all the council sought for witness against Jesus to put him to death. This is his defense attorney, his composite corporate defense attorney, according to Jewish law, seeking for witnesses to put him to death. But interestingly, they found none. Something went wrong in that trial. And verse 56 says it quite clearly, for many bear false witness against him, but their witness agreed not together. I'll tell you quite simply why it didn't agree. The system was designed to keep this very thing from happening. So under Jewish law, no two witnesses could be in the courtroom at the same time. Only one witness was allowed at a time. He would stand right in the center of that semicircle so all the judges had equal view of him. He would say what he came to say. He would then leave the room, and then another witness would be brought in, and he would have to testify without the benefit of having heard the first person speak. You understand the problem? So that if the first person's testimony did not exactly line up with that of the second witness, you have a problem. And it was the responsibility of Caiaphas, as soon as it became obvious the witnesses were not agreeing, under Jewish law, it was his responsibility to dismiss the whole proceedings, declare the accused innocent, and end the trial. Now, time after time this happened. These people came in, they weren't capable of even memorizing a story well enough to have two witnesses agree, and so under Jewish law, it was impossible to convict. We could go into more detail on that, but what I want to do is forge ahead here and focus on the major thing, that is Christ's power to forgive under circumstances where you see truth and justice butchered. Because I think, folk, we are going to see that happen. And I think we need to learn the lesson of forgiveness. Well, down here is another instance of that in verse 57. There arose certain and bare false witness against him, saying, "We heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another temple made without hands." Now, what's offensive about that statement to the mind of the Jew in 31 AD? What really gets under their hide about that statement? Pardon? Well, they love that building, that's for sure. Now, the thought of destroying the building is aggravating, but why did they go on and say he will build one made without hands? All right, blasphemy, sure. Do you see an overtone here of righteousness by works? He's going to get rid of this thing that we did, and he's going to build something that we didn't have any part in building. Now, that's old-fashioned spiritual pride. That is a problem that could be faced even among Adventists, isn't it? The concept that if I don't somehow get involved in doing it, if I let the Lord do it, you see, there's somehow some deficiency there with respect to me. And I see there probably as significant in that statement that the anger arose as much on the latter part of the verse as on the former. I will build another made without hands. We don't get to do any of it. And so therefore, our egos are offended. We reject this kind of salvation. But you notice something in verse 59? Even that story could not be told by two people in a row with sufficient clarity and agreement to make it stick. Now, this group of people called the Sanhedrin wants worse than anything to convict Jesus, and yet even they had to admit that the testimony simply wasn't coming in correctly. Even neither so did their witness agree. Why didn't it agree? Because there's no Holy Spirit there. The Holy Spirit of truth is not helping in that particular proceeding. Well, now verse 60 shows the next act in this drama. And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus. Now, why do you suppose he stood up? Can you see him? You know, getting his legs kind of untangled from the pillow. And you've been sitting there cross-legged a while. You have to kind of, I can see him putting his hand on the shoulder of whoever's sitting next to him so he can get up. Because this fellow's not particularly young. And getting his legs uncoiled and getting on his feet takes a little bit of doing. It's very undignified. It's not the kind of thing that a man will do when he's trying to preserve the dignity of his office, but he is upset. The adrenaline level is sufficient now that he is no longer possible to sit. He stands up. And what does he do? He asks Jesus a question, because Jesus has stood there with beautiful, regal serenity during this whole thing. The power of forgiveness. You see, the average individual in a circumstance like that will begin to holler and yell and defend himself, and those balls that are pitched at him would be hit back harder than they were pitched, and the system would energize, and pretty soon you would have a verbal brawl. And Jesus leaves the energy out of the system by saying nothing. All these things are thrown, but they fall flat. They don't go anywhere. They just die as they land. And Caiaphas can't stand, and he says, "Please, play the game. Let's get something going here. Let's mix it up." And he says, "Answerest thou nothing? What is it which these witness against thee?" Caiaphas is hoping Jesus will be a typical human being that can take only so much until it snaps and he fights back. And what does verse 61 say Jesus did? He held his peace. Now, maybe it is not entirely the best to use a very limited and perhaps very temporary example on a tape that will have perhaps longer life than this particular world crisis in which we live, but I cannot help but think about the events in the Middle East today. There have been two impacts now, two different occasions in which Iraqi missiles have impacted Israel. At least as far as I can determine to this point, Israel has not responded. When they do, what will happen? We don't know what will happen, except to say we know it will not be good. Now, when they respond, if they do, they will re-energize the system, you see, as long as they forbear. Can you imagine the wild frustration of Hussein, who says, I'm throwing stuff at their cities and I can't get them to do something dumb? Now, here's the same thing happening in the trial of Jesus, you see. What is it which these witness against the end? Jesus held his peace. Well, the high priest, finally, decides that he will ask Jesus a question that divinity cannot fail to respond to. Again, the high priest asked him and said unto him, Art thou the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? Now Jesus answers. You know, in Matthew, the account of this has it, I think, perhaps a little more specific. It says, I adjure thee in the name of the living God, art thou the Christ. You address divinity in those kind of terms and you can get a result. You will guarantee a result. You may not hear what you want to hear, but God will respond, and so did Jesus. And what did Jesus say? Two magnificent, almighty words. I am. And that's all you need to say. Why is the name of God I am? I used to wonder about that as a kid. What is there about that short, complete sentence, subject and predicate, that dignifies itself as a name? Always has been, always will be. What about life? Do you and I have inherent within us life? No, we don't. No. We have no more life within us than these electric bulbs have electricity within them. We are capable of using life, but we do not have it within us. Turn to John. Turn to John 1. And I'm going to read it to you out of the New English Bible because it really explains why the term I am is such a valid name for God. Gospel of John, chapter 1, verse 1. When all things began, the Word already was. Through Him all things came to be. No single thing was created without Him. All that came to be was alive with His life. And there's the answer. Who only hath life. Isn't that what the apostle said? God only has life. So that everything that came to be was alive with His life. And the life that you and I enjoy this afternoon is not ours. It is derived from the Son of God. We're borrowing life from Him. He only has it. Which means when we take the life that we derive from Him and make it sin, we are very, very properly to be said as crucifying Him afresh. Taking the life of God and bending it into all this nonsense we do. That perhaps alone is reason enough to want to quit playing with sin, isn't it? So Jesus says, I am. I am. I don't derive life from anybody. I simply exist. And for all eternity, your mind may search that point out. You'll never get to the bottom of that. That's beyond human comprehension. I am. Then he went on to give Caiaphas a little more than he had asked for. He said, And ye shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power. Now, remember which scribe it was that sat on the right hand of the high priest? The scribe that voted for acquittal, for salvation. So when Jesus ascends to the right hand of God, what are we really saying? We're not playing heavenly geography here, so much as we are saying that Jesus ascends to the position under Jewish law that makes Him our acquittal scribe voting for our salvation. And that's why we ought to look at the plan of salvation and say everything has been stacked in our favor. If we lose it, we'll have to throw it away. Now, a lot of people do that, but there's no excuse for it. How shall we escape if we neglect so great salvation? So Jesus said, you'll see me again. And when you do, you'll be on the right hand of power. And then the high priest took those beautiful garments, which were representative of what? Of the righteousness of Christ, and tore them. And once again, Jesus sees a system butchered that was designed to prevent doing this very thing. And the high priest says, "You've all heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" And verse 64 of Mark 14 says, "And they all condemned him to be guilty of death." Now, under Jewish law, that immediately, once again, required Caiaphas to dismiss Jesus and set him free. And in that, Jewish law differs from every other system in the world. We generally say that if 12 people can leave the jury box, go out, and 5 minutes later come back in and say, "We all agree, Judge, the defendant is guilty. We all agreed on that. We had no argument whatever." Typically, we would say, "Well, that's sure an open and shut case. No 12 people ever agree that quickly unless the evidence is very strong." But under the Jewish system, it wasn't that way. If there was an immediate and unanimous verdict of guilty, Jewish law said you must turn the prisoner loose and declare him innocent, because no 71 people ever agree any time, as that quickly on anything unless there's something there that doesn't appear. This smells like a mob. As a matter of fact, you couldn't even have anybody in the Sanhedrin rise and speak against the accused until someone had risen and spoken in his defense. He had to have a friend at court. Once again, that's a plan of salvation. See? So at that moment, it was the duty of Caiaphas to turn Jesus loose and set him free. Instead, they sent him out for crucifixion. Well, the procedure for the Jewish death march was without parallel in the history of the world. Never seen anything like it. As the culprit had been condemned and led away to his doom, there was a man stood outside the door of the Sanhedrin hall there on the hill of Zion. He held a flag up in the air. Because you see, until the messenger came back and said the execution had been carried out, it was the duty of the Sanhedrin to go on debating the case. They're still trying to save his life. And they had the saying that a Sanhedrin that convicts somebody oftener than once every 10 or 12 years was a butcher shop. Their idea was you save life, you don't take life. So there was that man stationed with a flag in his hand at the entrance of Sanhedrin Hall. And behind the execution party, there was a herald on horseback. And he rode and he followed this group of people, the soldiers and the condemned person, followed them to the place of execution. At least his horse did. But the man himself looked back. He kept his eyes fixed on Sanhedrin Hall so that if the flag came down, indicating the Sanhedrin had come up with a theory by which they might overturn the conviction, he'd gallop forward. He'd tell them, "Come on back. Don't carry out the execution. Come back. We're going to rehear the case." And meanwhile, a herald would go along proclaiming to the gazing multitude, "If any man knows anything favorable to the accused, in the name of God, let him come forth and speak, in order that the accused may be led back to Sanhedrin Hall." Now, in the crowd that by this time had gathered, because Jerusalem wasn't that big a city in those days, and the word had spread quickly, you suppose the streets were fairly well lined with people? In the crowd that had gathered, there is every probability there are people in that group who could see Jesus for the sole and single purpose or reason that he had given them back their sight. There were lepers who had been cleansed of leprosy, and that was the only reason they could be there in a crowd. I wonder if the man who was healed at the Pool of Bethesda was there, able to walk there that morning. What about that widow's son from Nain? Is there a possibility, because it's Passover season, everyone's coming to Jerusalem, that he maybe walked down there and he's in the crowd? He's been given life. What about the nobleman's daughter? How many people are in that crowd that wouldn't have been there if it hadn't been for Jesus? And here comes the herald, because they're trying to do it by the cookbook to make it look like it's a valid and genuine trial. And the herald says, "If any man knows anything favorable to the accused, in the name of God, let him come forth and speak." And not a soul steps forward. And the prophet said it best, "He trod the winepress alone." And a tribunal whose own rigid legal procedure made it powerless to convict even a aggravated felon, if a shred of legal theory could be concocted for the defense, had convicted the Lord of creation by bending every single known rule of Jewish procedural law. And what was Jesus' response? Enormous energy it took to demolish that temple of justice that the Jewish people had built for a millennium. And Jesus took the energy out of the system with three simple words. Father, forgive them. Then he gave the reason. They don't know what they're doing. And that we'll talk more about later on this afternoon when we talk of the role of the Holy Spirit in cleaning up our lives. But all the energy of evil that could have been exploded into a great human confrontation was taken out of the system by a simple act of forgiveness. And Jesus seems to respond, "You have the physical power now because it's been granted you to do this with me, to beat me, to say untruths about me, to finally nail me to wood. You got that in your physical power. But there is one thing you cannot do. You can't make me stop loving you." And therein, I think, lies the real answer to how we handle things when they go wrong. Thank you.
You have been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright American Cassette Ministries, all rights reserved. To order CDs or audio cassettes of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 1-800-233-4450. International calls, please dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americancassette.org. There you will discover the largest selection of genuine Adventist preaching available. American Cassette Ministries is not a one-man band. It's an orchestra with outstanding speakers who are all on the same theological page. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Cassette Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? Our email address is info@americancassette.org. We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and financial support are important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.